Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So let's start with believe it or don't, okay? We're going to be talking about health controversies. So we had a couple of emails, and I hope that you'll enjoy the program. Let's start out with a headline. FDA questions common practice of getting COVID and flu vaccines together. This is Vinay Prasad, our new top vaccine regulator, handpicked by RFK, and you know what that means. So he wrote in a memo that FDA officials cannot affirm the safety and efficacy of administering multiple vaccines for coronavirus, flu, and other conditions such as RSV at the same time. Don't you believe it? Okay? The fact that the FDA cannot affirm it, technically true because no one has ever done placebo trials, has to be weighed against, decades of evidence that they work and that giving them together still cuts down the frequency of those diseases. The fact that it's worked for decades, the fact that it is the standard of care and has been across the planet, has to be weighed against the sort of persnickety little dodge that, well, we've never actually tested it. Vinay, apparently you are very ignorant about medical therapeutics. Easily 90% of the drugs that are currently in use, being prescribed right now, have never been tested for, fill in your group, Prussian grandmothers, people of various ethnic groups. I mean, yes, they've been tested, they've been given to these people, but has anyone ever done a double-blind placebo-controlled trial to see if Prussian grandmothers suffer adverse consequences? No, because it's impractical, and we've done the we've done the biological experiment in the wild, and there are certain things we just know. But what this is doing is it's creating a absolute deliberate shortage of corona vaccine this fall. Pfizer has been negotiating with the FDA as it sought federal approval for its updated corona vaccine, and this new stance has put tens of millions of vaccine doses at risk. This is something that has to be produced in advance. There's some lead time where if they're not going to make them if they don't have a market. Now, this FDA memo does not prevent pharmacies and doctors from providing these vaccines at the same visit. And like I said, don't you believe it? In fact, another thing that happened recently is that the FDA narrowed approval last week of updated coronavirus shots to just high-risk groups. And who is that? Well, anyone 65 and older, anyone with an underlying condition that elevates their risk, like, for example, diabetes or obesity, which covers, I'm sure, 50% of the adult population practically in the United States right now. They're saying, oh, well, there's a study. One CDC study showed that people who received flu vaccine and coronavirus vaccine at the same time were slightly more likely to have fatigue, headache, and muscle aches than people who only got the coronavirus vaccine. Well, I'm sorry, but this is a big fat duh. Every time you get a vaccine, the vaccine contains something called adjuvant. This is an irritant. The purpose of the irritant is to get the attention of the immune system. Hey, look over here. Attack this. And without waking the immune system up, you don't get as good a vaccine response. Now, the problem is, of course, it's that we're giving multiple doses of adjuvant. And so I do recommend for people who are very frail to space the vaccines out a week apart, not because the vaccines are dangerous, but because it makes for a rough ride for the patient. And if we're in an pandemic situation and people are pounding down the hospital walls with a new disease, and we've got people in tents in the parking lot. Yeah, get the vaccine, even if you're getting too much adjuvant or multiple adjuvants at once. You got a risk-benefit ratio here that people need to really take a look at. To quote the vaccine czar, if we want to call them the czar, but the head of the CDC vaccine coalition or commission, who was named Jha, he said in an interview, "The burden of proof is not on manufacturers to be able to do something that clearly has been done millions of times safely. The burden of proof is on people who are calling this into question, given the long-standing track record we have of co-administration of vaccines." So, getting another short vaccine story. This actually coming out of Oregon Science University. "Maybe we don't need to be giving tetanus boosters to adults," the article says. "We could safely drop tetanus and diphtheria booster shots for adults and save an estimated $1 billion a year, according to a new review led by researchers at Oregon Health and Science University. We spend a lot of money on vaccines. Obviously, that money needs to go to other sources like beefing up ICE. So instead, let's drop the 10-year schedule for adult and match what's done by the World Health Organization. Now, the vaccine here in the United States is usually given as a combined tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis vaccine. So this article misstates what the World Health Organization says. They're talking about dropping the 10-year adult tetanus boosters. But DTaP contains pertussis and diphtheria. And the diphtheria actually is a natural adjuvant. So part of the reason that it got put into the vaccine in the first place with the tetanus was, hey, look over here, immune system. That same alerting signal that we want to get. So France has a recommended booster vaccination. The United UK doesn't. There's no difference between tetanus rates in the two. And no difference in diphtheria, which basically is not surprising because you really only get that once. What this article misses is pertussis. Okay, pertussis is whooping cough. And I can tell you after 35 years of practice that when someone comes into my office and they say, "My God, I've got this terrible cough." It's usually after Thanksgiving or after some family holiday. "I've got this terrible cough, doc. In fact, I cough so much I'm throwing up." I'm like, okay, that's probably pertussis. They'll be wheezing. You'll hear little extra sounds in their lungs. But primarily what they've got is irritation of the airway leading to paroxysmal coughing. And this is no fun. We don't have good drugs for it. It can last up to 6 weeks. That's my clinical observation. And now that we've shut down the codeine and the Vicodin cough syrups, and you will consistently be told at CVS that, oh, we don't stock that. We don't have that. It'll take 2 days for us to get it. We'll be happy to order it for you. Well, great. I'm coughing all night now. Thanks very much. We don't get herd immunity for pertussis. The P in the pertussis, that's why we change the vaccines. Because the pertussis is a nasty bear. And when you give the vaccine with the live pertussis virus, you get really good immunity, decades of immunity. But 1 in 50,000 children gets a very bad reaction, and a few of those children die. And that's not acceptable, and I'm not saying it is. But when they changed the vaccine and gave an acellular vaccine that did not contain basically, it was just a different pertussis vaccine called the acellular pertussis vaccine. We have found out, to our disappointment, that it lasts about 4 years. And you've got, after 2 years, you can get pertussis again. After 4 years, you're probably going to give it to your grandbaby, which is why grandparents have to get the pertussis shot when there's a newborn in the house. And that is recommended by the pediatrician. And because whooping cough kills babies, it's pretty generally enforced by the mom. This article completely misses the fact that we're not really after the tetanus. We're after the pertussis. And there is no pertussis-only vaccine that I'm aware of that's approved for use in the United States. So we're kind of, you know, up the creek without a paddle here. Okay, I've probably given you enough downers. Here's a little bit of an upper. California, Oregon, and Washington announced today that they are launching the new West Coast Health Alliance to uphold scientific integrity in public health as Trump destroys CDC's credibility. Well, I can't argue with destroying the credibility of many of our institutions. This was a joint announcement made by the governors Gavin Newsom of California, Tina Kotek of Oregon, and Bob Ferguson of the state of Washington. And the alliance will, quote, help safeguard scientific expertise by ensuring that the public health policies in California, Oregon, and Washington are informed by trusted scientists, clinicians, and other public health leaders. Through this partnership, the three states will start coordinating health guidelines by aligning immunization recommendations informed by respected national medical organization. This will allow residents to receive consistent science-based recommendations they can rely on. And they also made, this is a state's rights issue. And, you know, that's actually, I was taught back in the day that states' rights was about what the Civil War was about. You know, some states have the right to have slaves and then federal government saying, no, you don't. Well, some states want the right to have vaccinations. Fortunately, public health is largely under the control of the states. I am really worried, folks, about the supply issue. So I am hoping that other states will follow along with this so that we can ensure the safety of the public this winter by making sure that the manufacturers don't have adequate amounts of vaccine in the pipeline, because if they decide that they don't want to take millions of dollars, be left holding millions of dollars of perishable product, they can just make less and create a shortage. So this might be the year, and I don't usually recommend this, but if this keeps up, this might be the year to get that flu shot a little bit on the early side. Now, this is a first. This is my first AI email. It wasn't actually sent to me by an AI. It was sent by Koi in Big Sur. Let's see what Koi says. Thanks so much for your great show. Below is an idea which was formed after watching a great episode on the history of TB on Crash Course, a YouTube channel. It talks about history, evolution of humans with this disease, and blind spots of economics of medicine, pharma, and capitalism. Lyme disease could also be in this convergence of fields in evolution of the human immune system, economics, and medicine. I use ChatGPT to help associate the convergence of fields of science. This is where I think AI will be the most useful first for us, is in convergent technologies, until it isn't. See what you think and pass it on. So, Koi, I would caution against trying to equate the Lyme and the TB and tie them with the same tropes. There's a lot of conspiracy stuff out there that tends to creep in to the AI, and we'll come to that a little bit long. So I would score this effort, The Evolutionary Weight of TB is the title. Let's see. The second sentence is misleading. It says that TB is present in one of four people globally in the latent form. I don't think that's accurate, but it definitely is misleading, because the distribution of tuberculosis, an infectious disease, which is actually fairly hard to catch in contrast to COVID, you actually need to be in a room, probably a poorly ventilated space, with someone who has active TB to catch it. And so in the in early industrial revolution and in places where people are crowded together in poorly ventilated sleeping spaces, it's a big problem. So that is absolutely true. We don't have much latent TB here in the United States outside of one or two groups, and that is people who work in law enforcement, particularly in the prison system and people who work in hospitals. And people in medical settings are exposed to people. Most of the people who expose them are recent immigrants to the United States, or they're very old people who have reactivation TB. There is a statement here that is accurate, although I did not know it, so I learned something. Thank you for that. TB is able to persist silently within immune cells. That's true. It does a sort of stealth hide in dead macrophages. It does not hide in living immune cells, but it hides in these big sort of Ziploc bags called macrophages, which are amoeba, and chomp down like a Pac-Man, chomp down on bacteria. Latent TB is now understood as not a totally dormant state, but with low-level replication and immune engagement without symptoms. This is true. In the case of tuberculosis, the body basically crowds it into a corner and then builds a brick wall around the corner and posts guards outside. And if it tries to get out, it tries to reactivate, then the immune system is right there. Therefore, if someone is put on a drug deliberately designed to reduce the immune system, for example, if they're put on Remicade or one of the other immune system inhibitors that are used to fight everything from Crohn's disease to psoriasis nowadays, we check people for latent TB. The next part of this article tries to tie tuberculosis to sarcoidosis, fibromyalgia, and long-haul COVID. And it's essentially saying these things are alike in that the immune system is overactivated. Then it moves to the conspiracy theory aspect of the for-profit system. So, yes, the emphasis of the market-driven healthcare system in the United States that we were just talking about in reference to vaccines is focused on diseases of affluence and infectious diseases, to the at least as far as the vaccine industry is concerned. It is not focused on it is focused on chronic conditions that require medication, not cures. That's true, although every now and then we do get a cure and we jump up and down and celebrate. I think we're motivated to cure. I don't believe that cures are being suppressed because the industry wants to keep letting people suffer. I think that is nonsense. I would like to see some evidence. The other things in your article that really struck me as wrong was the statement over and over again that we do not have good testing for latent TB. Latent TB is not common in the United States. We have good testing for it. It's called QuantiFERON. The prevalence of positive QuantiFERON is low in the population. And this is a high-risk population, that is to say the healthcare workers and so on. And we have a heck of a lot of long COVID here. So for the most part, I think that it is pulling together, that your AI pulled together stuff and tried to fit it into the thesis, the prompt that you gave it. And in doing so, it sort of fudged a lot of the data, some of which I don't know that the layperson would be able to even recognize was being fudged. There's a lot of spin out there, and there's a lot of spin in this thing that you sent me. So thank you, though, because it's cool that I got an AI, a letter that was effectively a foreword of a person of the letter that their AI generated. We're now going to move to FDA's, what I think are somewhat appropriate concerns around the unapproved GLP-1 drugs being used for weight loss and for other purposes. So when semaglutide, that is to say Ozempic, came out, there was this huge splash on the internet, and everyone was very excited. And then it became clear that this stuff is really, really expensive. And there has been this amazing, capitalist medicine-driven flurry of activity. First, there was a shortage, and then the people who make it were able to bring up the supply. But meanwhile, back on the fringes, we have compounding pharmacies, and compounding pharmacies started making what they purported to be exactly semaglutide and exactly Mounjaro. Unfortunately, there are a number of things coming out lately, very fraudulent, very scary. Fraudulent compounded semaglutide and tirzepatide that contain false information on the product label. In some cases, the pharmacies on the labels don't exist. They're being resold by a international pharmacy that consists of, a call center somewhere and a post office box and just farming this stuff out. They're even falsifying the name of the pharmacies. In fact, so if you do purchase something and it's kind of on this gray market of drugs, I don't like gray markets for injectable drugs. It's getting a little close to scary for me. But anyway, if you buy on the gray market, at least check to make sure that pharmacy exists and that they make the product and that their name and identity effectively hasn't just been hijacked. And look for spelling errors. Look for incorrect addresses. Think about, all of those AI tells when, the images with six fingers, for example, which was one of the ways you could tell an AI image for a brief moment there. They've gotten much better. But do double check with the pharmacy if it looks dodgy. And another problem is dosing. A lot of people are getting these products in vials, and they may not know how to draw up a vial properly. The drug vials, for example, that are used for insulin are either a half of or a full cc. So you're getting a very, very small amount of drug. Some of the versions of semaglutide I've seen are much more concentrated than I expected. And I could see people looking up the dose on the internet and saying, oh, I'm supposed to take 0.5 cc's of this, and actually giving themselves an overdose. And that has, in fact, happened. Now, it hasn't killed them. It doesn't kill you. In nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain, and constipation, you'll live through that. There are a couple of drugs that aren't even FDA approved that are showing up in one of them is retatrutide, and the other is cagrilintide, and neither of these are FDA-approved drugs, but they are actually showing up. And also, versions of the drugs that are intended for research that are not purified are showing up as well. So we are in the Wild West between the counterfeits and the veterinary, let's call it veterinary versions. They're intended to be used in mice. Dosing errors. It's a jungle out there, folks. And if you choose to buy in the gray market, take precautions and really ask yourself if it's really worth it. I want one last thing. Millions and millions of people take up on with this drug. One of the things we're going to see is a certain kind of cancer. They're part of a syndrome called multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome. And about 1 in 30,000 people has the DNA that makes them very vulnerable to getting cancer from this. So, yeah, if 100 million people start using this and there's a 1 in 30,000 rate, we're looking at some unnecessary cancers showing up, rare cancers that may not be so rare, but I'll tell you, they're damn difficult to diagnose. And most of the first three or four doctors you go to with it are not going to know what's going on, most likely. Because the last time they saw one of these was medical school, if they saw it in medical school. And here's another aspect of GLP-1. It's now being promoted all over the internet as a longevity drug for mood elevation and wellness and reducing joint pain. Well, it probably does do the joint pain. The mood elevation, I think, might very well be placebo. And there are 15 telehealth firms and medical practices across the country that are currently promoting GLP-1 drugs for longevity. And there's no scientific evidence that proves that taking smaller than standard doses of either of them is safe or effective for anything. The microdoses just are essentially hype, and there's no data to support it. So we're going to move from GLP drugs to our first on the phone caller. Hello, Dr. Mutika here. You're on Ask Dr. Dawn. Give us your name and where you're calling from.
This is Helen. I'm from here, local.
Hi, Helen.
And here is my question. You're talking about this drug. I know a number of people on this drug, and one was not in this area, but sent to emergency ER from vomiting and all that stuff that you're talking about. My concern is that she might be one of the few people, and there are others I know, who have this genetic anomaly that can create cancer. I'm wondering, is there a genome test she can take?
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how commercially available it is. Oh. It strikes me as one of those things. If you have a complete genome done, which is doable for about $1,000 now, you can find
it. Is that the 23andMe?
No. You would need to do one of the complete genome tests. And there's a number. I don't have a particular company to recommend, although kind of interested in doing that. Haven't done it. Mm-hmm. The point about that those tests are that you need help. You need a decoder ring. They're very complicated.
Yeah.
The terminology is very complicated. So you want to go, if you do decide to recommend that to your friend, she wants to look at the reports that people get from the company and make sure that they have a customer service that will actually relay her question about this particular gene. And
doesn't have $1,000.
I'm sorry. Well, she had some money, or she wouldn't have been able to get into trouble with the GLP drugs.
That's true. I don't know in her state if she's on Medicaid and Medicare. I'm not sure. But, that's a good question. I can ask her. But, so the complete genome is one, with a good customer service is one way of doing it.
That's one way. Somebody may have come up with a test. I mean, it would make sense now that we have so many people doing this and, you know, committing essentially in the case of treatment of obesity to pretty much lifelong therapy with the agent.
Mm-hmm.
And so that starts to look like a cancer risk to me. And yes, it's a small number of people, and if you have a serious disease, but if you're microdosing it because you think that it's helping your mood, and maybe, you know, the irony is taking it as a longevity drug and it gives you cancer because you have this gene.
Right.
You know, that's like an Aesop fable or something, you know. I don't want to see anyone go there without their eyes open. It's a small risk. I'm not trying to magnify it, but it's when you multiply a small risk by large numbers, you start to get cases.
Right. So this woman's obese, and that's why she's taking it. And I know others who are taking it for the same reason. So you said that was one way of doing it, the complete genome for about $1,000 mm-hmm. and good customer service.
Well, the family history can be revealing, but it doesn't always tell you that much because these cancers are hard to diagnose. But if you've got a number of family members with, you know, like weird thyroid cancers, adrenal cancers, anything that's a hormone producing, like pancreatic cancers, all of those things, and these are syndromes, so there are multiple different patterns, and one's called MEN1 and one's called MEN2. So they're like clusters of cancers that tend to run together that we have established are hereditary. I have no further, fine detail to give you, but this is something that if you search, if I were going to do a Google search, I would search GLP-1 drugs, multiple endocrine neoplasia. And then
multiple endocrine
neoplasia. Yeah. And then it will, Wikipedia or just the whatever browser you're using will give you what you need to search further. And then you can, put back in and say, well, can I buy a test for this mutation?
Okay.
If she's got Medi-Cal or Medicaid, then
she's not going to be born anymore, so Medicaid, yeah.
Yeah. So
I mean,
if she's got,
I don't know if she still has it now. She's working, so I don't know. But go ahead.
Well, her insurance might cover it if she, if but only if there's like a strong family history. They aren't, you know, if there'd be so many false positives, you know, so many people, you need to find one cancer or prevent one cancer. You're having to test 29,999 people. The economics just don't work, no matter how cheap it is. And ultimately, you know, we have a market-driven system that makes economic decisions, and we, you know, put our hands into our pocket when we're really motivated. I hope that she's successful in losing a lot of that weight, that she gets her dose right, and
because she's having problems with the GI problems that you're talking about that sent her to the ER. I don't know if she's still on it.
Right. Well, probably she's scared of it now, but she might be able to. She might still be able to go back on it and start at a much lower dose or try the other agent. And their molecules are different enough that that might work.
Okay. Or a different agent. She's also a cancer survivor. She's had breast cancer, and that was premenopausal. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that puts her in the endocrine
hormone. No, it does not.
It does not. Good.
No.
Good.
The breasts... Okay. The breasts produce a lot of things, but they don't make hormones.
Ah, okay. Because some of them are hormone-driven, I know.
Oh, but, yes. That's different than manufacturing the hormone.
Okay, got it. Okay, this is helpful.
Well, thank you.
I'll
I'm glad I was helpful.
I'll send her back to her primary care regarding a genomics test. Would that be useful?
I think the first thing I would suggest in a situation where you have a clear and present danger to your health, like obesity, is if you can find a way to not be obese, that's going to have so much statistical benefit.
Spanish. She's tried everything, so that's why this is last resort.
Well, I mean, short of surgery, and if this works for her, the benefit of that is more than balances the risk of the MEN. I'm really making the argument not on an individual basis, but on a public health basis.
Got it. So if I'm hearing right, the nausea, vomiting, all this GI symptoms aren't necessarily a red flag that she has the cancer gene.
No, it's a known side effect.
So what she might consider is either lowering the dose or going on a different one in that class. Let it
all damp down and then, you know, cut the dose in half. She might have to learn how to use a syringe because they sell these things in these pens that are supposed to prevent people accidentally giving themselves too much. That's one of the advantages of the pens because learning to give yourself sub-Q injections is a bridge too far for many people.
Right.
So, you know, having this little spring-loaded thing like an EpiPen that you just... You know, you don't even see the needle and it just kind of pops down and, you know, squirts you and you don't, you know, it's much better. But it's also an device that can be patented and expensive and blah, blah, blah. We're back to the dance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Let's chat a little bit about the trials and tribulations of getting psychedelics through the FDA. We've definitely been a medical controversies program. In 2024, Lykos Therapeutics looked to have set up the first psychedelic approval by the FDA for MDMA, which is otherwise known as ecstasy, using it for post-traumatic stress disorder. However, the FDA rejected the drug's approval application. And they just thought they had it nailed down. So what happened? Well, among other things, ripples across the entire drug development industrial complex, as this is a new territory, the idea of having psilocybin and other psychedelics that could be used as psychological agents under FDA approval that allows insurance to pay for them. It just opens up a new market. So it's like westward ho, so to speak. And both the psychedelic and the botanical drugs like psilocybin are being investigated in mental health indications. And even using the guidance of the FDA on best practices, Lykos managed to fail. And they probably paid the price for being first, because as they presented their data, they ran into a serious catch-22. For those of you who are younger and don't and never heard of the book and never saw the movie, Catch-22 relates to a provision, Section 8, I believe it was, but I might be wrong about that, that you can get out of the Army if you're certified by an Army psychiatrist is crazy. But then if you actually want to get out of the Army, you're clearly sane, so much for that. So the difficulty that was faced here is that the FDA was requiring a solid double-blind placebo trial where both the investigators and the patients could not tell if they were getting the drug. And, of course, because of the effects of the drugs and its impact on consciousness and perception, the patients knew whether they were getting the drug or the placebo. Even if they were drug naive, they figured it out. Because it had such a profound effect on people's mentality, their attitude. Remember, we're trying to treat post-traumatic stress syndrome, so you can pretty easy tell if the person's better. There was no way that this was really blinded. And what can we do? Because this is going to be a problem with all of them. Many mental health trial endpoints are traditionally based on patient-reported outcomes because of this problem, compared to usual course. And this is, if only patients who got the drug report higher benefits, this, you know, might also extend to clinicians. So it's become nearly impossible to do the placebo trials. Interestingly enough, benzodiazepines managed to get through for anxiety, panic disorders, insomnia, and seizures. There were challenges during the study, but somehow they managed to show that it, probably because the instructors themselves, the dramatic improvement wasn't so dramatic the next day when the drug had worn off. And so therefore they had actually a shot at being blinded themselves. Another thing you can do is have the person making the judgment have no idea which group the person is in. That's called a single blinded study. And of course, you can just edit out the high and the psychedelic experience and see whether you still get the same benefit. There's a botanical drug company called Adja that's developing a daily dose of the serotonin-like molecule that's part of psilocybin. And they're going to run it in a trial with other antidepressants and with placebo and see if they can show that it's going to work. But there's another problem that is kind of unique. I mean, you can pop a Valium into a person's mouth and a placebo Valium into another person's mouth and leave, you know, send them to a space and score them, send someone else in to score them on their anxiety. And you kind of get a pretty good idea if their anxiety scores drop over a couple of hours. But it's a snail's pace compared when you're trying to do psilocybins. People are kept in a room, usually a separate room, 8 to 10 hours, maybe even an entire day. There has to be one or two people in the room. If you're really trying to do this as close to a double blind as you can, there has to be someone who's scoring in the room, and then the psychotherapist is there. It's also a problem because if the funding drops out while you're doing one of these, the therapists leave because they need to eat, and you have to start all over with a new therapist, which, because you have a different person judging what is intrinsically a fairly subjective judgment, that throws your statistics into question, and we're off to the races again. So let's move on to a couple of emails. Fred sent in Bryson says, here's a bit of information. I thought you'd find it interesting. And this is an article about B vitamins affecting your brain and your heart health. So I first want to talk about biotin because I want everybody to know about biotin. A lot of people out there are taking biotin, which, if I've got my numbers right, is B7, and they're taking it for their hair. They're taking doses of like 5 grams. That's 5,000 milligrams. I've seen packages up to 15,000 milligrams. And that is many orders of magnitude above what's considered the minimum daily requirement, which is like 50 micrograms. So it's a microgram is a thousandth of a milligram. A milligram is a thousandth of a gram. We're getting into very, very high doses when we do that kind of math on B vitamins. But they are harmless. And the only problem is that they harm your lab values. The one I'm most interested is that it causes your thyroid tests to be off, and you can get a false positive test for being hyperthyroid. It also interferes with your troponin, and that is the test that the emergency rooms do to find out if you're having a heart attack. So if you have a heart attack and you go in and you're taking 15 milligrams of biotin, you might not show an elevation in your troponin, and you might be sent home, unless you make sure you let them know that you're taking this, and hopefully the doctor will realize that it could throw off the test, or at least will make a phone call to the lab or check their smartphone for biotin and troponin and decide whether or not they want to do additional testing to confirm the absence of a heart attack. So let's talk about cognitive health. And by the age of about 80, 40% of people have a diminished ability to absorb B12 from food. And the vegans out there, you know, have a really hard time getting enough B12 because it's made by animals, and there are very, very few sources of it. So B12 levels can be in the low to normal range, but people are having a functional B12 deficiency, because plasma levels don't really tell you functional adequacy. And in fact, age-related cognitive decline is not just Alzheimer's. It's among the things where we've overlooked blood vessels and we've overlooked nutrition. So the brains use a lot of juice. It's like a very high consuming electrical appliance in your house. Uses a lot of power. And if you don't get nutrition and the appropriate vitamins and, first of all, get them into the bloodstream from the gut, whose blood supply is also impaired as you age, then once they're in the bloodstream, they have to get to the part of the brain that needs them. And as your blood vessels shrink and become partially clogged, that becomes less and less possible. So many cardiovascular surgeons think that cognitive decline can be caused by a combination of low vitamins and circulatory deficiency. And if you've had an MRI or a CT scan, if you have little white spots, those are usually indications that you may have some vascular deficiency. It's considered normal aging, but your best way to pinpoint vitamin B12 is to check methylmalonic acid, or MMA. That's an intermediate. And if you don't have that intermediate, then you've got a problem. We also want to check folate, and that's homocysteine. Again, measuring a serum folate level can actually be misleading, because some people lack an enzyme that allows them to particularly supplement folate, but also natural folate has to be transformed before it's useful to the body. And if that transformation process is impaired, you'll see high levels of homocysteine. So we can look at anyone with cognitive decline and show that if they have low high homocysteine or high methylmalonic acid, we can slow the process by giving them simple B vitamin supplements. And let me just say, this is a lot. It slows it about as much as that Alzheimer's drug slows the progression of Alzheimer's. You know, that very expensive drug that causes major brain side effects like swelling and bleeding that got approved by the FDA recently over the objections of the entire panel of experts. I mean, there's been something rotten in Denmark at the FDA for a while. B12 is definitely an issue. The other B vitamins that we know about that are important are B2, riboflavin, and it actually decreases blood pressure. So if you're struggling with blood pressure and you happen to know that you have that MTHFR genotype, you'll want to be taking extra B2. I did not know this until I read this article, so I want to thank Fred for pointing that out to me, because I test for the MTHFR in patients, and so I'll know I need to be giving a few people a call and make sure they're getting enough vitamin B2, riboflavin. And then there's B6, which can help reduce the risk of heart attack and strokes and dementia. Studies in the 80s showed that B6, B12, and folate supplementation didn't decrease heart attacks, but they did lower the risk of strokes. And of course, when a study doesn't do something, that doesn't mean it doesn't do something. It may mean you didn't give enough, or you didn't give it for long enough to see a difference. That's always the problem with studies, I'm afraid. Niacin can lower bad cholesterol, but it requires high doses, and most people get flushing. I want to just mention on the subject of B6, I've had a number of patients come in and be told, oh my God, you're toxic on your B6. And the problem with that is that B6 stays in the system for 24 hours. So if you if you're taking a B vitamin and your doctor for some reason checks your B6 level, then if you haven't been off those B vitamins for 24 hours, you're going to come in looking toxic. It's used off-label for mushroom toxicity for people who have, you know, liver toxicity from two mushrooms. And in that situation, they give 15 to 20 grams of B6 for a couple of days. However, doses greater than 25 grams a day for more than 2 months have been shown to cause sensory neuropathy, and that's why the doctors are worried. You come in with neuropathy, they check your B6 just in case, and they find it high, and it's all just a mirage because you took your B vitamin that morning. So extremely important little details about the nuances of the B vitamins. One or two short stories. You're going to love this one if you're an ocean dweller. Ocean air can add years to your life, research shows. This comes out of Ohio State University. They did a study. People living in coastal regions enjoy life expectancies a year or more above the United States average, while city dwellers near inland rivers and lake may actually face shorter lifespans. They think the difference comes from environmental and social factors, primarily clean air and flood risks, but not all blue spaces are great. The correlation between longer life expectancy and water was clear for those who live within about 30 miles of an ocean or a gulf. Maybe milder temperatures, maybe better air quality, maybe safer recreational opportunities, but it's not just living near water. And in fact, living near inland waters may actually confer a slight hit to life expectancy compared to the national average. So I guess the most important thing to say about that is walk along the beach if you possibly can. It's a very, very big deal. Coming up next week, we're going to be talking about how anticipation of being infected because you see someone who's sick may actually goose your immune system in acting as a sort of neurobiological adjuvant to get your innate immunity revved up. And we'll also be talking about the impact of acute and chronic stress on the physiology of the gut. We'll call that the microbiota gut-brain access perspective. And of course, there'll be your emails. I want to remind you, you can, during the week, if you want to send an email, go to askdrdawn.com and hit the Contact Us button.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to askdrdawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.